How do you tell another person's story of trauma? How long should you wait? How much sympathy should you show? And why make the victims relive their trauma? These were questions spinning in the head of Rana Rico-Rizzuto as she headed to Hiroshima to interview survivors of the world's first atomic bombing. But no question could prepare her for what happened when she arrived, the terrorist attacks on September 11th. Rana Rico-Rizzuto's book, Hiroshima in the Morning, confronts how the trauma of today can bring up the pain and suffering of the past. Here's Rana Rico-Rizzuto reading the opening lines of her book.
I can tell you the story, but it won't be true. It won't be the facts as they happened exactly, each day, each footstep, each breath. Time elides. Events shift. Sometimes we shift them on purpose and forget that we did. Memory is just how we choose to remember. We choose.
The way you start this book, Hiroshima in the Morning, I can tell you the story, but it won't be true. It's fascinating, isn't it, to look at something that matters this much to you, and you know you won't be able to tell it all?
Yeah, that's kind of what happened to me when I went to Japan. I found out that nothing is true. You know, I had written a first book about the Japanese-American internment, and I had spent years interviewing internees there. And the fascinating thing to me was always that nothing was the same. Everything was true to one person or another person, depending on, you know, where they were at that time in their lives. And so everything is true, but at the same time, there's not that truth that we expect when we look at history.
So why, for you, did it suddenly become important? Why did you want to tell this story?
Well, there's kind of a long answer to that question, but in my first book, I had been looking at silences, and the silence that I was looking at there was the silence of the Japanese-American internment, which, again, I hadn't learned very much about that in school, but also my mother had been interned, and her entire family had been interned, and we had never talked about it when I was growing up. So when the reparations happened, I found out, you know, in this big shocking family way that my family had been interned, and I went to make that story. And in the process of making that story, I ran into a great aunt of mine who had been interned, but she was more interested in talking to me about something else. She wanted to talk about Hiroshima because she had been in the internment camps, and when she was let out of the internment camps, she joined the occupation and she went to Japan, and she was one of the first Americans who saw the bombed city. My great aunt, single girl in her 20s, in a shiny black car with the doctors. They're going to house. They're visiting the mothers of stillborn babies. Molly is a file clerk for the Americans, or a statistician, but she can also be an interpreter. She can ask the grieving mothers for the details. Where were you when the bomb was dropped? She can ask for the body of the dead baby. I remember her every word. I thought we were helping. When she found out, and how did that happen, that she was the enemy, that the U.S. government was classifying all that information so no one could fully understand what the bomb did, that they were offering no help and no medical care, and here begins the outrage. That's when she became a peace activist. I'm almost sure that's what Molly told me. I had no other source of information, so it had to come from her. But when I returned, just over a year ago, surrounded by silence, suffocating, to really listen to her story, Molly had finally forgotten.
Are all stories like that? Are they all things that we didn't pay attention to the first time around?
I don't know, but I do think that you have to be ready for certain stories, and I certainly wasn't ready for that one. You know, I think that that's part of the question of memory and history and silences and how we allow those silences to happen, because at different times in our life, there's something that we're looking for and something that we want to see, and if we see it, then it satisfies our notion of what is and what exists in the world, and then we can go forward. And if we're not looking for that, sometimes we just, you know, it's like it's invisible.
Do you have to be careful when delving into stories that way? You know how much horror there is in the past. Do you worry about ripping open the wounds?
I tend to let people take the story where they want to take it, talk about what really resonated with them. But what I did find after September 11th was a kind of an opposite experience, which was not that I had to be careful not to rip people's stories open, but that they were so traumatized by what was going on in the world that they needed kind of a repository. So all of a sudden, I had people calling me and asking me to come and talk to them because they had this story boiling up inside of them and they had to get it out and leave it somewhere.
Did you feel as though your role in the discovery of this story changed for you when 9/11 happened? You are, I should say, a New Yorker, and your family was there, though not right next to the towers. So it must have felt very personal, even at such a distance.
It was quite an experience at such a distance. My husband was on the Brooklyn Bridge, and he saw the planes, and he was really in the middle of it, and yet he kept saying, everything is fine, everything is fine. And so everyone around me was very upset because for them, you know, they're barely surviving on the idea that there's world peace and safety, and now there is no world peace and safety. And the people in New York are saying everything is fine, and it was a very surreal experience. But the thing that really happened with 9/11 for me and for the people that I was interviewing was that it shattered that narrative that they had created, and it left them with kind of the mess of what had actually happened because all of their memories came back.
And as you say, they had constructed over a period of half a century a mm-hmm. narrative that gave them a feeling of security and of comfort. And then they had to go back and start it all over again, too.
Right, right. I mean, it's a healing narrative. If you have any idea of what it looked like after this bomb dropped and the way that people died and the way that the skin just like peeled off of their bodies and they just kind of melted and incinerated and some of them didn't die right away. And so the families had, you know, several days of trying to deal with the pain with nothing. I mean, there was not even any clean water there. The nightmare of that is something that the human mind can't deal with unless it processes it down. And so it was very important for them to process it in order to heal. And then all of a sudden it was open again. And it was like, oh my God, you know, if the people who died did not sacrifice themselves for world peace, and if we actually don't have world peace, and if this might actually be something that could happen again because the United States is bombing Afghanistan and, you know, the lessons that we thought were learned have not been learned, then what do I do with that? How do I survive on a very basic human level? We ate the remnants of dried beans. They used to crush the beans to make oil and take the meat for food, and then they'd take the skin off, crush it together, and somehow make it into a round cake. That's what they were feeding the horses, but they kept some for human consumption, and I remember that was ration too. We ate those. We would break them into little pieces and put them in the water and try to make some kind of soup. Pretty soon there wasn't even rice, not even brown rice. I remember eating any kind of leaf from any kind of vegetable and eating ordinary grass. When we ran out of vegetables, everything was eaten, anything edible. Here's another kind of thing we had to eat, inago, a small grasshopper. They said it had a lot of protein, nourishment, so we used to capture them in the rice fields. We'd dry it and cook it with shoyu or something, just to get the flavor. 71-year-old male survivor.
The stories, you use them regularly throughout the text. There's one later, a female survivor. It's the little things that matter, isn't it? She was lying on the ground, and she doesn't remember or doesn't talk, I think, about her own pain so much, but she mm-hmm. remembers a woman carrying a mortar.
Right, right. And then she put it down, and then she died.
And that's what, clearly after half a century, still springs to mind for her. How do you find a story like that?
I just sit and listen, and sometimes it takes quite a long time if you're doing it in two languages and you have a translator, but I let people go where they need to go. And I had an experience once where a friend of mine who's she's an amazing simultaneous translator. We were in a park and she said, well, let's ask a question. And I asked, what do you think about war? And I had this one woman come up to me and she started talking about Afghanistan and talking about the kamikaze boys who had sacrificed their lives. And she was looking at me and I was looking back at her. And the fact that she felt seen, she just poured everything out. I would nod and I would look at her and I would hold her gaze and she just went to the place that she needed to go. And it all gets collected on tape and, you know, transcribed and all that kind of stuff. But it's that human connection that if you are present for a person, if you will be their witness, they bring up what they need to bring up.
Rana Rico-Rizzuto is the author of Hiroshima in the Morning,